All right, well, tonight we're going to conclude a series on the Old Testament book of 1 Samuel. So if you've got your Bible, I want to encourage you to open up to 1 Samuel. We're going to start tonight in chapter 24, and we're going to survey chapters 24 through chapter 31 in the final lesson of this series that we've been calling A Heart God Desires. And this is part number 9, the last of the series, and we're going to look at all these chapters together tonight. But before I introduce it, I want to read the first part of chapter 24 as an introduction, as the scripture for tonight for our consideration and study. 1 Samuel chapter 24, verses 1 through 12. After Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, David is in the desert of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 able young men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. He came to the sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were far back in the cave. The men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Afterward, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. And he said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of the Lord." With these words, David sharply rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul, and Saul left the cave and went his way. Then David went out of the cave and called out to Saul, "My lord, the king!" When Saul looked behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He said to Saul, "Why do you listen when men say David is bent on harming you? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not lay my hand on my Lord, because he is the Lord's anointed.' See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but I did not kill you. See that there is nothing in my hand to indicate that I am guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs that you have done. But my hand will not touch you." This is the word of the Lord. In 1 Samuel, beginning in chapter 24, going through the end of the book, what we read about is a cat and mouse game of King Saul persistently pursuing David. In Saul's rage, he repeatedly tries to kill David. And David has several opportunities, in fact, to kill Saul, but he refuses to do harm, and every time David says, "Because Saul is the Lord's anointed one." Now, though Saul had almost been driven mad with jealousy and rage, David still had a heart of respect for the position of the king. And so tonight, as we conclude this series, A Heart God Desires, what we're going to see David possessing in these chapters is a heart that respects authority. But the question that I think we need to grapple with, that we see through these chapters, is just what kind of authority should you and I respect? All kinds or only certain kinds? Well, we're going to gain some insight into the answer to that question as we look at David being pursued by Saul through really four episodes in these chapters. You have the robe episode, which we just read, the feast episode in the next chapter, the spear episode in the following chapter, and then the remainder of the book is what I would call the medium episode, that is the witch of Endor, the medium that can conjure up spirits from the dead. And we'll look at all three of those very quickly by way of survey, and then we want to pull it all together and start getting really practical about the idea of the heart God desires is a heart of respect. Let's look first at all four of the episodes. In chapter 24, we have this robe episode, which we just explored in the reading. We see that David is being pursued by Saul's army, and Saul, at some point in the pursuit, goes into a cave. And the Bible is trying to be delicate here, and it says he relieves himself. You know what's going on there. And so David, just it so happens, and his men are further back in that same cave, hiding from Saul's advances. David has every opportunity in this moment when Saul is very vulnerable to kill the king, but instead he chooses to sneak up behind him and cut a corner of his robe off, and he says again, let me remind you, verse 6, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of the Lord." So David, you see, would not allow his men to attack Saul, but instead revealed to his men how Saul should be spared because he is the king. In chapter 25, we have what might be termed the feast episode. This is when David is still being pursued in the wilderness, and David and his men try to get aid from a wealthy landowner nearby by the name of Nabal. Nabal is a very crass and outspoken individual who disrespects and mocks David, which fuels David's wrath. And David would have sent his men to actually go and kill Nabal, except Nabal's wife Abigail meets David on the way and intercepts David and his men, prepares a feast for them, and convinces David not to take action against, and this is Abigail's own words, "my foolish husband." In fact, he's been named rightly. Nabal means foolish. Well, he was named rightly because my husband is foolish. Now, when David hears this, he says in verse 39 of chapter 25 to Abigail about how that she, because of what she did, she has kept David from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing on his own head. David is thankful to Abigail that she stayed his hand against Nabal. This is the feast episode. Again, we see that David is being restrained from taking action. Action that he probably was justified in taking, but he is restrained. This restraint is again going to be demonstrated over and over again, not just in the case of Nabal, but once again in response to the king Saul. In chapter 26, we see the spear episode. David again in the wilderness, he discovers the camp of Saul and where they're camped at, and he takes one of his men, Abishai, and they sneak into the camp in the middle of the night while the king is sleeping, and somehow they're able to stealthily approach the king, and they get right to him, the sleeping king. And David refuses to allow Abishai, despite his insistence, David refuses to allow him to kill Saul. David says to his servant, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay," this is verses 9 through 11 of chapter 26, "who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As surely as the Lord lives, the Lord himself will strike him, or his time will come that he will die, or he will go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed." So you see this again, David is restraining himself. Because David respects the authority of the king. Instead of killing Saul, David in this instance, much like in the cave episode, in the spear episode, David takes Saul's spear and his water jug from beside the sleeping king, revealing again how he had every opportunity to kill the king, but he spared his life yet again. And Saul then makes the claim in verse 21, because David has exercised restraint yet again, Saul, in a moment of weakness apparently, says, "I will not try to harm David ever again." Well, that's an outright lie, but he says that in verse 21. That gets us to the fourth episode, which I call the medium episode, verses chapters 27 through the end of the book. You see, David knew that Saul's madness would discredit his claim that I won't do anything to harm you, that his madness would cause him to continue in jealousy to pursue David and eventually try to kill him. So he decides, David does, to escape into the neighboring nation, the land of the Philistines. And the Philistines begin to assemble around about that time an army to go against the armies of Israel led by Saul. Well, in his fear, Saul seeks counsel from God. He wants to know, what should I do? The Philistines are coming. David and his men have taken refuge somewhere in the ranks of the Philistines, and the Philistines are now going to come and they're going to attack us. And so he seeks counsel from God, but because Saul on numerous occasions has been disobedient and has turned his back on God, God is silent. Well, Saul continues to try to seek counsel. He tries to turn to the prophets, but he's run off most of the prophets. Samuel the prophet has recently died. He's not available. So Saul then turns to I think the King James says, the witch of Endor, the medium of Endor, this person that is dabbling in witchcraft. And so Saul goes to the medium of Endor and asks her to do something for him, to conjure up someone from the dead that Saul could speak to and get advice from. Well, the medium is very hesitant to do that because she says, don't you know, by the way, Saul had disguised himself. Don't you know, she says to the visitor, that if I do this, that I could be killed because King Saul has cast out all the mediums and all the people that practice witchcraft out of the land. He reveals that he is, in fact, the king to her and says, don't worry, I will not harm you, but I want you to do this for me. So she, in the arts of witchcraft, which are forbidden by God, calls Samuel the prophet back from the dead. It's seemingly to her own surprise. She shrieks in terror when Samuel appears. But Samuel appears and he says, back from the dead, he says to King Saul in verses 17 through 19, the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hands and has given it to one of your neighbors, to David. Because you did not obey the Lord, he will deliver you into the hands of the Philistines. And so we see, as we continue reading in the chapters, that in fact a battle does ensue with the Philistines. Saul is critically injured in the battle, and rather than being captured by the enemy, Saul falls on his own sword and dies, chapter 31, verses 1 through 6. Those are the four episodes that round out the book of 1 Samuel. What I want you to see from all of that is that when you compare the leadership of Saul and David, you see a drastic difference, a vast difference in these episodes between these two men. We see that these two men exercise two different styles of leadership. Saul, increasingly, because of his madness and his actions and his demanding respect and demanding authority, actually is losing the respect of most of Israel. Meanwhile, David is more and more rallying people to his cause, and he is earning their respect. So as we think about a heart of respect tonight, I want us to first go back and do a little, we're going to get contemporary now and drive it home. But in order to do that, I want to do a little bit of a history lesson, which many of you will be familiar with. Some of you may not have thought of it in these terms. There was a major shift in our culture that happened during World War II, but really, the roots of it went way further back. A shift in culture began happening in the 18th century. It's a time that you've probably studied in school called the Enlightenment. During the Enlightenment, philosophical thinkers began to promote among the masses the idea that modern people should question all tradition, all revelation, and all external authority. They began to plant those ideas. Well, that was back in the 18th century, and it was a pretty major culture shift in the thinking of modern man, and yet modern society continued to pretty much operate in the same fashion that it traditionally had, being dominated by stable institutions in society. but it was following World War II that the seeds of the philosophical thinking of questioning tradition, revelation, and external authority began to really take root and sprout in the minds of people following World War II. And you say, why would that be? This is when a real movement, it really started to get traction, this idea of anti-authoritarianism. And you say, where did that come from? Well, it started back in the 18th century with the Enlightenment, the idea of rejecting authority, but it took root after World War II for this reason. Our men went to battle overseas in this worldwide conflict, and what they saw absolutely shook them to their core. And that is, you had authoritarian governments practicing this authoritarian nationalism to a radical level. These rulers and dictators who said, it is your responsibility and duty as the citizens of this nation to not question the authority of the leaders. And you need to follow blindly because it's your duty to follow this authority. Well, you see, when our men came back from fighting that conflict, you can understand why they wanted to get as far away from that kind of radical authoritarian nationalism as possible. And that Enlightenment thinking that we ought to all be free thinkers, that we ought to reject any institution that would try to infringe on individual freedom, began to really pick up steam to the point that today, since that time, the predominant view in our world is that really there is no authority that any of you should answer to except yourself. That you are your ultimate authority. In fact, the message of culture is today that you should not subject yourself to any external authority because your own reason, your own intuition, are your only moral authority. Now, that is further developed in more recent times into what is called now, not modern thought from the Enlightenment, but postmodern thought, which is the thought that really there is no such thing as any absolute truth, that in fact every individual is only accountable to themselves, that every individual has their own truth. There is no absolute authority or truth to which we should all submit, but that every person is a free-thinking individual and you're only accountable to yourself. That's the history lesson. That's where we are. Now, how does 1 Samuel speak to that? Well, in what we've just looked at in these four episodes, I would say, first of all, we have to realize that without some level of organization, the world is only left to complete chaos. Originally, when God made the world, in Genesis 1 and verse 1, it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and without, it was void. It didn't have any structure to it. It was chaos. And what did God do in the remaining verses of chapter 1 of Genesis? He began to bring order and organization to the created world. Without some level of organization, you absolutely have chaos in the world. Just like we see later in the biblical story, actually prior to 1 Samuel, in the time of the judges, when every man did what was right in his own eyes. See, that's the kind of world we live in today. Every person is their own authority. And you had chaos in Israel. Absolute chaos. Human beings need a level of organization in order for human interaction in the world to be able to work. Human organization is displayed then in various ways, from families, there's a level of organization, governments, clubs, law enforcement, churches, etc., etc. So organizing human relationships then does require some level of administration in order for there to be some level of organization and without the world just being in chaos. That requires someone being designated as an authority figure that makes decisions or directs a group of people, whether that be the father of the home, whether that be law enforcement, whether that be governing officials, or whatever. So as much as we might react against what we've seen in history and go to the opposite extreme and resist all ideas of authority it just is not sustainable for human conduct in the world. It is absolutely foundational for any human interaction in society that there be some levels of authority. The only alternative is anarchy. And anarchy, the word anarchy literally means the complete absence of any recognized authority. If you have no authority, it's anarchy, it's chaos. But the problem comes in when we go back and we look at contrasting Saul and David. Leaders possess two different kinds of authority: positional authority and relational authority. Positional authority comes by virtue of the fact that you have a title, a rank, or a status. It is authority that is given by virtue of a hierarchy or of an organization. So God warned Israel against their desire for a king that would only exercise positional authority. Go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8. We looked at this in an earlier lesson, but I want to remind you of it now. 1 Samuel chapter 8, and we'll begin at verse 10 and read through verse 20. Samuel, this is 1 Samuel 8, begin at verse 10. Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. And he said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants, your male and female servants, and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will give a tenth of your flocks. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When the day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen. But the Lord will not answer you in that day." Now, what's he warning? This is long before Israel even had a king. This is when they're calling out for a king. God is saying, listen, I warn you. If you get a king, you may end up having a leader who is only exercising the authority of his position. All leaders do have, by virtue of being a leader, By virtue of being a recognized authority figure, all leaders have positional authority. There's no getting around it. But if that is the only authority that they exercise, it will be harmful and destructive to a people and ultimately to the leader himself, just like it was Saul. God took the kingdom from Saul and said through his prophet in 1 Samuel 13 and verse 14, "But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people." You see, to lead God's people well, they needed a man who not only showed positional authority, but who showed relational authority as well. Well, David, when we see him being pursued by Saul, we see that David had a respect even for the sole positional authority of King Saul. He refused to kill the Lord's anointed one. You see, he recognizes the authority of the position. I mean, David endured ill treatment, continually being pursued by the king, living day to day in hiding. And when you read this account, and especially when you read the poems, the songs that David writes while he's being pursued, there are many of them preserved for us in the book of Psalms. It is clear that David had no respect for Saul as a person. Zero respect for him as a person. But he did have respect for the office of the king, the positional authority of God's anointed one. And this is a distinction that is the reason why Peter later would write to Christians in the New Testament. And he would say in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 13 through 17, listen to what he says to Christians. Now keep in mind, these Christians that Peter's writing to are being severely persecuted for their faith. They're being persecuted mercilessly by Nero the king. I mean, Nero the emperor. He is slaughtering Christians, killing Christians, persecuting Christians. And listen to what Peter writes, 1 Peter 2, 13-17. Submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, verse 17, honor the emperor. Now, this emperor Nero was brutally persecuting and murdering Christians. Certainly, you can have no respect for that man. And yet, Peter says, respect the positional authority of the emperor and try your best to live in subjection. Now, that's not easy, but that's what a heart of respect does. This is what David did toward King Saul. He respected the anointed position of the king, all the while praying that God would somehow remove this oppressive leader. Many of David's psalms, most notably Psalm 18, Psalm 57, Psalm 59, reflect how David is running from Saul and meanwhile praying for deliverance from his enemy. The same enemy that he refused to kill in the cave, refused to kill while he was asleep in the camp because he had respect for the Lord's anointed. So at a time like this, David would sing the words of Psalm 11, "In the Lord I take refuge. On the wicked he will rain fiery coals and burning sulfur. A scorching wind will be their lot." So while David was on the run, he was earning the respect of the people of Israel. Unlike Saul, who was losing the respect of the people as far as his relational authority is concerned, David was gaining respect constantly. His reputation was such that it was even spreading to the neighboring nations. This is 1 Samuel 29, verse 5. They'd heard about how David had the things that David had done, the exploits, the victories David had procured. So when David then becomes king, he would be a vastly different king than Saul. In his position as king, David would exercise relational authority among his people, not just the position of the office. But instead, he got involved in the lives of the people and exercised his authority was found not in respect me because of the role I'm in, but instead, he won the respect of his people by his influence. Notice the difference of David's leadership as reflected in the Psalm of Asaph. This is Psalm 78, verses 70 through 72, written by Asaph. The Psalm of Asaph, Psalm 78, 70 through 72. Listen to what he says about David. Speaking of God, "He chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheep pens. From tending the sheep, he brought him to be a shepherd of his people, Jacob, of Israel, his inheritance. And David shepherded them with integrity of heart, with skillful hands, he led them." Notice that David led the people. He didn't drive them. Unlike Saul, David did not throw around his positional authority weight. Instead, he exercised relational influence and led his people where they needed to go. So in closing, David had respect for the positional authority of God's anointed one, Saul. Even though Saul had gone off the rails as a leader and really didn't deserve respect, a heart of respect will respect positional authority as much as possible, even to the point of Peter saying, "Honor the emperor." But respect in the truest sense is not something that can ever be demanded. It is something that is earned. David gained influence through his relationship with people, and they grew to respect him, and they willingly followed his lead. You see, hearts grow in respect when leaders exercise relational authority, not just their position. The truest king of all, the heir of David, the son of David, models this better than anyone. Jesus led us by his sacrifice and his influence, by investing in relationship with his people. Listen to the words of the Son of David, Jesus himself, in John 10. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. Just as my Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. Jesus did that for you, friend. Jesus is the kind of leader you can follow because he came to have relationship with you. And if you've not entered that relationship, he stands and he invites you to come. Come and believe in him. Choose to follow him. Choose to change the way you've been living your life and embrace his life. Be baptized into Christ. If we can help you in that, we would urge you to respond. If we can just pray for you, if we can do anything to help you, come to Jesus as we stand and as we sing.